Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm Keith Bradshaw. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the FCC Board of Governors and the Professional Committee. Before I introduce our guest today, just a couple of housekeeping notes. First of all, everybody, please turn off your cell phones now, or at least mute them. We do put all of these up on the web now. Some of them, in fact, have gotten close to 100,000 views, so we have a very large audience out there. And we wouldn't want them to, large numbers of people to be hearing your phone ring. So please do that. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about our next couple of upcoming events. On Tuesday of next week, one of our members, Paul Schulte, is having hosting an afternoon cocktail party regarding his book, which may be relevant to some of the same audience here. His book is on the next revolution in our credit-driven economy, the advent of financial technology. That would be Tuesday of next week in the afternoon. Then on Thursday of next week, we have another lunch, and that will be Eric Fish, and he will be speaking on his new book on individualism and upheaval among China's youth. With that, let me introduce Andy Rothman. He is probably a name that many of you have known for many years. He has spent 25 years in China before moving to San Francisco a year and a half ago with Matthews. He is somebody who is reporters have turned to for years with detailed questions, whether it's about the power grid, which I've called him about, or about the housing market, or whatever it might be. He's an expert many of us have turned to. He was just mentioning this is the first time he's come upstairs. He's come in before to the ground floor. So let's all welcome him to the upstairs of the FCC.
That's right. I didn't realize there was anything beyond the bar at the FCC, so this is great. I really appreciate the opportunity to come upstairs now. I feel like I've graduated and join your quite distinguished list of speakers. I just heard that Alistair Campbell didn't really divulge the secrets behind the Iraqi invasion, so I'll give you my view on that if you like. But, never mind. This is kind of how I feel right now. The China expert industry has been getting a lot of turmoil and upheaval, but many of you are probably aware that this is not the first time in recent memory where people have been predicting the imminent collapse of China. These are just two of my favorite examples. The Economist cover used to hang on my wall in the American Embassy where I ran the macroeconomics office in the 90s. And I remember my political bosses calling me from Washington saying, well, the Economist says China's collapsing. Why aren't you telling us that? But we've moved on to what's going on today, which is rather confusing. And I want to spend a few minutes. Normally on these talks, I don't spend much time talking about the market, in part because my focus is on the economy, and also Matthews Asia is a very long-term driven investment firm, but we can't talk about China without starting with the markets. The question is, how bad are things right now? The media talks about this as being a collapse, a crisis, a crash, but I wonder how many people are aware that actually the Shanghai Composite Index, the main index for A-shares on the mainland, is actually beating the S&P 500 index on a year-to-date basis and soundly beating it on a year-on-year basis. The Shanghai comp is actually up almost 40% year over year. It is down about 40% from the peak, and that's significant, but it's not quite as bad as some people think. More importantly, and I think this is really crucial to understanding what's going on in China today, is that Chinese people really aren't paying as much attention to the stock market as we are. We've not seen a significant hit to consumer spending in China after the market peaked in the middle of June. And this is great. One of the reasons for this is actually not all that many Chinese people are in the market. We estimate that there's only about 50 million active investors, which is about 7% of the urban population. Even more importantly, Chinese people are well aware that the market is a casino. It's very volatile, very risky, driven by government. And as a result, most people, 73% of these active accounts, have had less than $15,000 in their account. So while we can find anecdotal examples of people who say they've lost their life savings, in general, that's not happening. Less than 1% of people in the market in China have had more than $1 million. And this explains why, as you can see on this chart, inflation-adjusted or real retail sales growth has not slowed down. 10.4% growth in July versus 10.5% a year earlier. We can also see that bank deposit growth has held up really well. If you compare the growth in bank deposits as the market's been tumbling, or actually if you go back and look at deposits as the market was rising, bank deposits were still going up by 10% a year, which is telling us that most people were putting most of their money in the bank rather than in the A-share market. We can see a lot of other numbers to support this. For example, you've all heard, no doubt, that auto sales have been weak. It's true. Passenger car sales are down 6 or 7% in July. But SUV sales, a separate category of vehicles, up 34% in July. Apparent gasoline consumption, up 10% in July versus down 1% a year earlier. I just came back from spending a month in China, including 2 weeks on holiday, and while I was in Gansu, in Dunhuang, which is spectacular, by the way, I saw an amazing number of people who had driven their cars from Guangdong. The kind of road trip vacation that we're used to in America has now come to China. The domestic tourism industry is obviously still booming. New home sales are up strongly, a little bit more on that in a moment. Express package deliveries up 47% year on year in July, on top of a base of a 49% growth the previous July. This is a great example of how online retail has exploded in China. 10 billion express packages delivered in the first 7 months of this year. So lots of examples of how the consumer is still holding up. I mentioned home buying. In July, we had one of the best months in a very long time. New home sales on a square meter basis up 21% year over year versus a decline of 18% a year earlier. And remember, we'll talk about this more in a minute, these are people who are buying a house to live in primarily and paying a lot of cash. The other big news, of course, over the summer has been the devaluation of the currency. The big mystery really is why they did it and when they did it. But what they actually did is not all that interesting. The currency was devalued by less than 3%. Trivial. You can see that on this chart. And it's even more trivial when we compare it to how much the renminbi has appreciated over recent years. If you go back a decade ago when they finally broke the hard peg, even after this recent devaluation, the renminbi has still gained 30% against the dollar. Through the end of July, the renminbi is up almost 60% on real effective terms. That's weighted against where China's trade goes. So this has been a really, really small change. But again, the question and my biggest concern is, why the hell did they do this? Why did they do it now? Why did they do it a month before Xi Jinping's going to the United States? One of the main arguments that we hear is they did it because trade is struggling. Well, let's take a look at that. That, to me, doesn't hold up much weight. In the first 6 months of this year, actually, China's exports did far better than almost everybody else's. China's exports were up almost 1% year over year, whereas global exports were down about 11%. So the problem in Chinese exports is clearly weak global demand. It's not really a competitiveness problem, despite the strong appreciation of the currency. Plus, if you're really going to devalue your currency to help your exporters, 3% is going to make a difference? Really doesn't impress me as an example, as a reason for this. So one of the other popular theories as to why they devalued the currency, and you'll hear this from some government officials, is, well, we really, really want to get into the IMF's SDR. But again, this explanation makes absolutely no sense to me. In part, because we know that the IMF told the Chinese that the mechanism you use to set the exchange rate is not part of the criteria for getting the renminbi into the SDR. Second, what did the Chinese do? They took a government-established fixed rate here and now moved it to a government-established fixed rate here. If I'm an economist at the IMF, this is going to impress me? Hard to buy that. In fact, I would argue that there's a possibility that they have weakened their prospects for getting into the SDR just on a political basis, because the final decision is not going to be made by economists at the IMF. It's going to be made by the board, which is political. And some people are going to say, well, we don't know what the Chinese are up to now. The biggest issue for the IMF has been what they call the freely usable criteria, which means on a practical basis, if I'm Greece and I'm borrowing from the IMF and using SDRs, I want to be able to understand the value of the renminbi at any moment. I want to be able to move renminbi in and out of Greece, and this isn't going to help with that at all. So it raises the question again, why did they do this? And what I'm most concerned about is, over the 30 years that I've been following the Chinese economy, typically when the government has made a significant policy decision, I've been able to call my contacts in different parts of the government and ask, what's going on? And I've gotten a consistent, sensible, rational answer pretty much every other time. In many cases, it's been after they've made a mistake. For example, some of you may remember a couple of years ago, the government spiked the SHIBOR, the Shanghai Interbank Market rate, and that created a lot of global anxiety. And I was able to call people in the government who said, well, we did this because we wanted to discipline a handful of the joint stock banks that we thought were abusing this market. We realized we made a terrible mistake and we're fixing it immediately. They did so. There was really no long-lasting damage. Fine. People make mistakes. This time, everybody I'm speaking to in the government is giving me a different reason. Some are saying exports, some are saying the SDR, but none of these are consistent or make sense. So my biggest concern is that we run the risk that we're going to see economic policy making in China become more like economic policy making in London and Brussels and New York and Washington, which means heavily driven by politicians who have no idea what they're doing. Now, this is a risk. I'm not all that concerned about it, however, because these are the only two parts, the intervention in this A-share market and the exchange rate, that have gone haywire recently. The rest of the economic policy management, I think, has still been realistic and pragmatic and pretty successful. The main thing I would point to is that the government has not panicked over these two events. They have not panicked over some of the weak manufacturing and construction data that I'll talk about in a minute. And they have not, as a result, increased credit flows, and they have not increased fiscal spending. There hasn't been a significant macroeconomic stimulus. So they seem to be grounded in reality and accepting the fact that, not surprisingly, growth is slowing down. And so I'm concerned. I'm going to keep an eye on this, but I don't think this is anything to panic over yet. This is really a slide mostly for Americans to talk about how the idea that a 3% devaluation after the currency's risen 30% is a currency war shot is a little bit silly. And also, most Americans, I think, don't realize what a fantastic market China has been since China joined the WTO for the United States. You can see that up on this chart. Now, I'm going to focus on what I think are the key mistakes that analysts are making, leading them to be overly pessimistic about China's economic prospects. But before I do that, I do want to acknowledge that the Communist Party itself is not a mistake-free zone. And certainly, I'm not aware of anybody who says that economic policymakers in China have been omnipotent or mistake-free. They make mistakes all the time. They've just generally been, in the past, pragmatic about it. But what I worry about in the future, the number one thing is the absence of the rule of law. On the one hand, you've got an economy and a society that are increasingly based on private property rights. Most people own their own home. Small private businesses employ most people. And yet, there's no rule of law. It's remarkable how far the private sector has come in China despite this, but this is not a recipe for long-term success over the next several decades. The lack of institutions that Chinese people trust, the lack of civil society, and free of expression when it comes to the political sphere. Obviously, you can say anything you want in China about economics, but not politics. All of these things, as the country is getting wealthier, are going to be increasingly difficult. The environment, you know, is a disaster. And then I've been concerned about the overly aggressive approach in places near Japan and the Philippines and Vietnam. I do see some signs in the last 6 months or so that that's calming down. I think the party leadership realizes they overstepped, and the risks there, I think, have receded. But these are, in general, the kinds of things that I believe
are a bigger risk over a 10 or 20 or 30 year horizon than what most people are talking about. Crash of the financial system, the crash of the property market. I don't see the risks there as all that significant.
So let's talk about what leads people to be overly pessimistic. I think the biggest mistake is not understanding that in a relatively short period of time, China has become an incredibly entrepreneurial place. When I started working in China in the early 1980s, there were no private restaurants. There were no private companies. Occasionally, a farmer would come in from the countryside and sublet somebody's apartment and open up a restaurant, and that would be great until the police would shut it down. Today, more than 80% of employment in China is small, privately owned companies. And in this context, when I mean private, I'm saying non-state, not listed versus unlisted. These are small entrepreneurial firms that any of us would find familiar. All of the new job creation in China is coming from these small private companies, and all of the wealth creation, obviously, coming from these small private companies. This means that the world's largest communist party has to continue to facilitate the environment for this: freedom of expression, freedom of movement of money, freedom of movement of labor, and eventually the rule of law. The second big mistake that I think leads people to be overly pessimistic is the rebalancing issue. For years now, people have been telling us that their biggest concern about China is that the economic model is unbalanced, unstable, unsustainable. And what they meant was the Chinese economy is driven by exports rather than domestic consumption. Even President Obama, Treasury Secretary Liu just said this again recently. I don't know why. They say that investment is too big and consumption too small. Well, these things have changed a lot. If you look at the chart here, you can see that the dark brown parts of the bar are the contribution to China's GDP growth each year coming from net exports. That's an economics concept, which simply means the value of exports minus the value of imports that go into those exported components. In the decade before the global financial crisis, when China was growing at 10% a year, on average, only 1 percentage point of that 10% growth came from net exports. In recent years, it's been about zero. And you can see here that my forecast for the next several years is assuming a zero contribution to net GDP growth from trade. Similarly, my estimate is that of all of the stuff that comes out of Chinese factories every day, by value, only 10% of that gets exported. 90% of what China produces is consumed in China. That's down from 80% about a decade ago. It's no longer an export-related market. Now, investment is still the biggest part of the Chinese economy, but as you can see on this chart, the contribution to growth is bigger and bigger each year from consumption. The peak in the growth rate of fixed asset investment in the Chinese economy came way back in 2009 at 30%. The last year it was about 25% was 2011. This year it's going to be about 12%. That's still a lot of growth, still a lot of demand for steel and iron ore and copper, but it's growing much, much more slowly for two simple reasons. So much infrastructure has already been built, so many houses have already been built, that the growth rates for both of those are now past in the rearview mirror. Doesn't mean a collapse in either of those, doesn't mean the end of demand, but it's growing much more slowly. And the consumption part of the economy is huge. Here you can see another way to look at this. The red line is the share of Chinese economy that comes from the tertiary part of the economy, which is services and consumption. This is going to be almost certainly the third consecutive year in which services and consumption is going to be a bigger part of the economy than manufacturing and construction. This, I'm finding in the United States, is a really difficult concept to sell people on, that China is now driven more by consumption and services in terms of share and growth than it is by manufacturing and construction. This is really important because we're going to talk a little bit about how those two parts of the economy are faring. And the third big mistake people are making is underestimating the Chinese consumer. This gets back to the rebalancing story, which is, as I just described, clearly underway. I hear a lot of people asking me, particularly in the United States and in Europe, why don't Chinese people buy anything? You're supposed to laugh. Thank you.
we all know that Chinese people buy a lot of stuff. And when I go back and ask people in the U.S. or Europe, why do you think Chinese people don't buy anything? They say, well, we've been told that consumption is only about a third of GDP, and in our country, it's two-thirds of GDP. That's not a reflection of weak consumption. It's a reflection of the fact that investment was growing at 25% year over year on average for 9 consecutive years through 2011. But as you can see on this chart, China is the world's best consumer story. Full stop. Only India comes anywhere close, and that's really a gain that India's made in the last year or so. But this is just a brilliant consumer story, and it's now driving the economy. 60% of China's GDP growth in the first half of this year came from consumption. And this is not U.S.-style consumption, where everybody's maxing out their credit cards and taking a fifth mortgage on their house. This is because of phenomenal income growth. Over the period 2005 to last year, real inflation-adjusted income growth in China was 7%. You can see on this chart the average for that period of time in both the United States and Hong Kong was 1%. Now, you can also see on this chart that the growth rate of income is slowing down. I would say that we need to be realistic and expect that the growth rate of almost everything in China is going to continue to be slower. Is there anybody here from the Financial Times today? Okay, then I can tell this joke. I love it that every quarter the FT says GDP for the last quarter was just announced and it was the slowest quarter of GDP growth in China since the Tang Dynasty. All right, I'm fudging a little bit, but you know what I mean. We're going to be able to say that almost every quarter for a very long period of time. After 3 decades of roughly 10% GDP growth, it has to slow down. This is a really good thing. We'd be really concerned if China was still growing at 10%, because how could they do that? So we need to get used to the idea that numbers are going to slow, but you know, numbers are still good, as I think I mentioned before. If you ask the Japanese government, they'll tell you that Chinese arrivals in Japan in July were up 105% year over year, and as you can see on this chart, Chinese visitors to Japan, and this is Japanese government data, are spending twice what the average visitor to Japan is spending. I also found it amusing when I was in China last week that, you know, they announced the long holiday. They got a 4-day holiday up there for the celebration of the end of World War II, anti-fascism, anti-Japanese holiday. And most of the Chinese I spoke to said, well, we're going to Japan. We got 4 days off. Also really important to keep in mind the base effect. What this means is that slower growth is not necessarily your enemy. So let me explain what this chart shows you. If you look at the red diamond all the way on the upper left-hand side here, that shows you that GDP growth 10 years ago was 10%. Last year it was 7.4, just adjusted to 7.3 yesterday, but let's forget about that. That 7.4 or 3 was multiplied on a base, the previous year's growth, that was 300% bigger than the base 10 years earlier. So what the brown bar shows you is that the incremental expansion, the increase in the size of China's economy last year at the significantly slower growth rate was 100% bigger than the increase a decade ago at the 10% growth rate. On the far right side, you can see that if China grows at 5%, which is the bottom end of my 5 to 6% forecast for 2020, it's still going to be a bigger increase. That means if you're selling goods or services to Chinese people, you would rather be doing business today at 7% than 10 years ago at 10%. If, like Matthews Asia, you're investing in companies doing business in China, this is actually a better opportunity. There's certainly more competition, which makes it harder to decide who's the winner and the losers are, but this is a better opportunity. And while manufacturing and construction is weak and is going to remain weak, it's not collapsing. This chart on the top of this page is privately collected survey data from privately owned manufacturing companies across China, which shows us that as of the second quarter, wages for manufacturing workers were rising between 6 and 7% year over year. That's not the sign of a collapse in manufacturing. The bottom chart from the Chinese government is data showing that in the first half of this year, income growth for migrant workers, the people who moved from the countryside to staff most of the construction and manufacturing jobs in China's cities, was up 10% year over year in nominal terms. Again, not the sign of a collapse. All these numbers are slower than they were before. I expect they'll continue to decelerate gradually. But again, not a collapse in my view. There is clearly now a distinct rust belt in China. The provinces in dark gray or brown on this chart, five of them, are China's rust belt, starting in Shaanxi, moving up through the northeast. This is where the construction-related industries, cement, steel, aluminum, glass, and the natural resources extraction industries are concentrated. And as I said before, we've passed the peak in infrastructure growth, in new home construction growth, and we've had a collapse in global commodities prices. Those five provinces in dark gray, GDP growth in the first half of this year was below 5%. It's bad up there. But in the other 26 provinces, GDP growth averaged 8% in the first half of this year. And those 26 provinces are home to 84% of China's population. So this doesn't mean everything's fantastic in China. It isn't. But we need to put these things in context. Now, another story that I hear often, which is that the shadow banking system is going to collapse, I also think is based on a misunderstanding of what shadow banking is in China. Primarily, the issue is it's very small, but other thing that's important is all the shadow banks in China are owned and operated by the Communist Party, which means when they screw up, like the trust companies, the government is able to react pretty quickly. You can see here that the growth rate of trust lending outstanding slowed from a 500% increase to negative 90% over a couple of years. Again, a pragmatic government. Debt is definitely a problem. And you can see I'm rushing a little bit through here. I've been speaking too long already, I guess. Debt here is a problem, but the debt problem is concentrated mostly in state-owned enterprises. Private companies have actually been deleveraging. And what this means is that the solution to China's debt problem is going to be shutting down the worst, most indebted, dirtiest state-owned enterprises in the areas with the most overcapacity, which happens to be in that rust belt. But it doesn't mean that we're going to have to see the kind of broad deleveraging or credit crunch that we saw, for example, in the United States, which would lead to a dramatic slowdown and hurt hiring at the private companies that are generating all the growth. So this is going to lead to more volatility and slower growth, but again, I think unlikely to lead to a collapse. As I mentioned before, one of the things that I'm positive about is that we haven't seen the government resort to a macro stimulus. So if you look at the red line here, this is the growth rate of outstanding total credit, total social finance in China, and it's continuing to slow down. This is a really good sign because GDP growth is slowing down. And even more importantly, most bank loans today are going to the small private companies that are generating all the growth, not to the state firms where we've got overcapacity and inefficiency and debt. This is a huge story, which I think hasn't gotten enough notice. I don't know if Nick Lardy has been through here to speak at the FCC, but his book that came out last year, earlier this year, Markets Over Mao, he's done similar research and come up with a similar conclusion, and I recommend that if you're interested in this story. Okay, I'm going to wrap up with the property market. This is another big source of misunderstanding. We've been hearing from people that the property market in China is going to collapse any day now for, I don't know, a while. One of the big things to keep in mind is that 90% of the people who are buying new homes in China are going to live in them. The level of speculation is fairly low. Now, this is surprising to many people in Hong Kong because everybody you know in China owns multiple flats. But you also know that the people you know in China are probably not average. And this data is from private surveys of housing agents across the country, and it's been quite consistent that 90% of the homes are going to owner-occupiers, and these people have to put down a lot of cash. And I'm now going to go to the videotape here, if I can operate this. And I'm going to show you a very short video on the subject of China's property market.
Ghost cities. For many investors, this is the scariest China story. Cities across the country, populated only by empty apartment buildings. But is China's property market really that scary?
You may have seen a report by CBS TV's 60 Minutes program titled China's Real Estate Bubble. It was first broadcast on March 2013. Host Leslie Stahl introduced the report by saying, "So this is Zhengzhou, and we are on the major highway or major road, and it's rush hour, and it's almost empty." 2 years after that report was broadcast, I visited Zhengzhou and went to some of the same places. This is what the same street looked like at 10:30 on a Thursday morning. Far from ghostly. 60 Minutes showed many empty streets 2 years ago in the new Zhengdong district of Zhengzhou. But when I spent a full day in Zhengdong 2 years later, I spent much of the time sitting in traffic. This big change over just 2 years isn't surprising. It reflects some of the big differences between the U.S. housing market and China's housing market. For example, almost all of the new homes sold in China are apartments, not single-family homes, and 80% of those apartments are bought 1 year or more before construction of the building will be finished, known as presale. That's one reason it takes time for new Chinese cities to fill up. And most of those apartments are sold as a bare concrete shell. Finishing the apartment, everything from floors to kitchens and bathrooms, can take another 3 to 6 months after the new owner takes possession. Another unique factor is that most new apartments are being built outside of the downtown areas in smaller cities because the traditional downtown area is too congested and land is unavailable or too expensive. The government is encouraging developers to focus on new areas away from downtown by building infrastructure, everything from subways to light rail, hospitals, and schools. In the new Zhengdong district of Zhengzhou, where 60 Minutes filmed, many apartment buildings were completed several years ahead of the opening of the subway line to the area. Construction began in 2009 of a subway system planned for 6 lines covering a total of 125 miles, and the first line opened in late 2013 after the visit by 60 Minutes. Many people in Zhengzhou bought apartments in the new area with the intention of not moving in for several years, based on the view that housing prices would be much higher after the subway lines were completed. This pattern is repeated across the country. China has more than 150 cities with a population of 1 million or more, while the U.S. has only 9 cities and 50 metropolitan areas of that size. Americans probably haven't heard of most of these cities, but they're not hick towns. For example, last year there were more new homes sold in the city of Hefei than in Beijing. More were sold in Chengdu than in Shanghai. Zhengzhou has an urban population of 6 million, which is about the size of the Washington, D.C., Arlington, Virginia metro area. You've probably never heard of Zhengzhou, but most of the world's iPhones are made there. There are a few other important differences between the U.S. and Chinese housing markets. To start with, Chinese use a lot more cash. New home buyers are required to put down at least 30% cash, far from the 2% median cash down payment made by first-time home buyers in the U.S. in 2006. The products that broke Lehman Brothers and caused havoc throughout the U.S. financial system just don't exist in China. There are no subprime mortgages, and there are very few mortgage-backed securities. There is no secondary securitization, so no CDOs or CLOs of subprime. China's residential property market is clearly very soft right now, but a housing crisis is very unlikely. Before we wrap up, let's return for a moment to the 60 Minutes report about Zhengzhou. Leslie Stahl visited a shopping mall that had no shops. When I went there 2 years later, that mall was still closed. Local officials told me that mall had never opened. But the problem wasn't lack of customers. It never opened because of a legal dispute between the builder and the individual shop owners. Meanwhile, another nearby mall I visited seemed to be doing just fine, with Starbucks and KFC and shops selling Converse and Nike shoes. There was even a Major League Baseball shop. Surprising, given that baseball is not really popular in China. And when I looked at the clothing on sale, I immediately assumed it was an unauthorized shop selling knockoffs. When I got back to the U.S., I spoke with Major League Baseball, and to my surprise, they said the Zhengzhou store was legit and is one of 250 licensed MLB shops in China. As for the unusual clothing, MLB explained that, quote, "The Chinese market, like many outside of the U.S., is a heavy fashion lifestyle interpretation of our brand." For more of our research on China, please go to the Sinology page at the Matthews Asia website. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there so we have time for questions.
Thank you very much. Why don't I just start off with one while everybody thinks about their questions. You were skeptical, I guess, that the devaluation was linked to a desire to do something on exports, and you made the argument that global exports were down 11%. China was nearly flat for the first 7 or 8 months of this year. On the other hand, global exports are down because iron ore prices have collapsed, oil prices are way down. A lot of it is commodities that the Chinese aren't exporting anyway. And if you look at exports in July and exports in August, they were down sharply year on year. And then on top of that, you had the State Council having a meeting on July 15th, for which they put out a circular, I think, July 22nd. The whole meeting was how worried they were about exports, and number two on their action agenda for something to do about it was, let's change how we set the currency. So why... I've heard the statement that it's not export-linked, but at the same time, it almost looks like somebody wanted to do something to help the exporters. Somebody else didn't want to do anything too dramatic to devalue, and you ended up with a half measure that didn't make anybody happy.
It could be. That is one explanation, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to me for a couple reasons. One is we've seen this story before. We've gone through periods of time where exports have been weak whenever global demand has been weak, and every single time officials at the Ministry of Commerce say, we're going to devalue the currency, and somebody at the State Council says yes. And to me, this is the actions of a typical politician anywhere. Someone is in charge of managing the constituency that's the export industry, and they're designed to represent their interests and say, we feel your pain. But when it comes time to make the final decision on what's going to happen on economic policy, they haven't devalued before. And exports are even far less important than they are before. And so I think that while you're going to see some officials say this is why we're doing it, it doesn't make sense, both because the situation isn't that bad. We're not seeing, like we were in late 08, early 09, dramatic unemployment, closing of factories across the border here. And also, if you're going to devalue to support exports, what's 3% going to do?
Truly a half measure. With that, why don't I throw open the floor and see who else would like to ask questions here. One over on the side here, please, first.
Thank you, Andy. Peter Kwong, Alpha Group. Just a question, two questions. First one related to the gold reserve in China. Recently, China has upped the gold reserve by 60-70%. Some say that's still way underestimated. The actual gold reserve is way more than that. What is your take on this? And what if someday China say, oh, we actually have, I know the U.S. has 8,000 tons. What if China someday say, oh, we have 7,500 tons? What do you think that will do to the financial market? Second question relates to the South China Sea. Recently, there was a spy plane flying over South China, some of the man-made islands there. Do you think the U.S. will keep doing this to provoke China, saying that, you know, you don't have, you know, the man-made island is not legitimate. Therefore, we will keep flying above the islands. What will that do to the U.S.-China relationship? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's take the last question first. I would assume that American spy planes are flying over those islands at least a couple of times a day. What was provocative in the particular incident you're probably referring to was the fact that they invited a CNN camera crew aboard the spy plane. A little bit unusual. There was obviously some political messaging going on there, but I'm not seeing them doing that on a regular basis. But, you know, that the Chinese understand that the U.S. is within its rights to do that, just like the U.S. Acknowledged that China was in its rights to have some of its naval ships off the coast of Alaska when Obama was up there a couple of weeks ago. So I don't think this is going to cause a problem. The issue is avoiding the kind of accident that we saw in 2001 when the Chinese fighter pilot flew into the U.S. spy plane. But I don't think that's going to be a particular problem. On gold, clearly the Chinese government has been completely untransparent on its gold reserves. And it's a bit of a puzzle why they're doing it. I'm assuming that they're adding primarily from domestic production, so it's really hard for us to know. I'm not sure, given that we know that the numbers are not necessarily accurate, I think most people are assuming that they're not, and we could be surprised again. When they made the announcement just recently, I'm not aware that that had any ripple effect through the financial markets, so I'm not sure this is a big issue. I guess if you're in the gold industry, it's a little bit more concerning.
Okay. Over here, please.
Hi, Andy and Christine. I would like to ask you two questions. First of all, is if China, because actually the big move on the devaluation of the CNY, if they really make a mistake, or so far we still don't know what's going on, actually. SDR maybe, or the devaluation is not enough, then actually it doesn't benefit to their export. Do you think any probability of China making a mistake like Japan in 1990s? That is the first question. And the second question is actually the devaluation of the CNY. Simultaneously, actually, China have to move their reserve. And then actually they sell US dollar in the market so as to defend their CNY. Simultaneously doing the two things, but there is the most harmful will be the bond market in US, and then the outflow money is crazy. But right now they need to defend the CNY, otherwise their outflow is more significant. So how do you think about these two relationships? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Good questions. I'm not very worried about China repeating the mistakes from Japan because China has the advantage of being able to learn from the mistakes, and I think they've studied that carefully, and we can see a lot of differences. For example, we've already seen a lot of progress towards rebalancing the economy away from state-owned, away from manufacturing and construction. We're seeing strong growth in wages. We're seeing a shift in the way credit's flowing. So I think they're doing a good job of avoiding getting into the kind of trap that the Japanese got into. I don't see a deflationary problem in China either. Core inflation, CPI minus food and energy, is holding at about the historical average of about 1.5%. So I think that doesn't worry me too much. On the foreign exchange side, what we've seen was a significant fall in the foreign exchange reserves last month. The number sounds quite big. It was about $95 billion. But remember, it's not that unprecedented. September last year, it fell by $80 billion. $95 billion is about 2.5% of their reserves. So even if it was to fall by that amount every month, it would take a long time for them to run out. I don't think that most of the foreign exchange reserve decline is explained by money fleeing China. I think a lot of this is coming from the spending by the central bank to defend the currency. A lot of it's coming as a transfer of foreign exchange from the central bank to domestic bank deposits held by Chinese corporates. A lot of it is coming from Chinese corporates, particularly state-owned enterprises, betting on the exchange rate. And now that the government has said pretty definitively that they're not going to devalue more for the foreseeable future, and I would guess that that's going to extend through the end of the year. And also the government's put measures in place which are making it far more expensive for companies to bet on the devaluation. I think we're going to see probably September would be the peak in the outflows in the near term.
Okay. Over here, please, in the corner.
Hello, Andy. I have two questions. Firstly, it is on Chinese potential debt problem. Because currently, from the data we have been seeing, is that fixed asset investment have accounted for more than 50% of China's economy. And then if you look more closely to the FAI, infrastructure might already count, you know, one-third of it. And besides that, we have property, mining, manufacturing. None of them, they are doing very good. So even for the infrastructure project, you can see the return right now is much more lower compared to 10 years ago. Because 10 years ago, when I saw the IRR, it was like 10%. Right now, it's only 6-7. So recently, we also have seen the bank's NPL has gone up. So do you think that the potential debt problem and also the bad debts can be a trigger for China's economy correction? Secondly is because I've seen you have a chart on China's consumption, which you are very positive on that. But my view is that, a lot of Chinese, they cannot afford to consume too much. Even they have a very strong, bank deposit, because if you look at their retirement scheme, if you look at the spending on the kids, and then also there is not a very good like medical protection system because not everyone has been covered. So do you think that the Chinese nationals can really afford to spend their bank deposit in order to support the consumption? Thank you.
Okay, good questions. Thanks. Let's start with the first one. I think we need to be very careful about how we evaluate the productivity or the returns of public infrastructure It's not really the nature of public infrastructure. The Chinese government, the banks, did not expect that when they built roads, bridges, power, water, rail, waste treatment, that this was going to be profitable. And it's not surprising that the biggest gains from these came in the early days. You remember, it's not all that long ago when we were worried about blackouts and brownouts across China, that there were runs on diesel generators because there was not enough power. So when the initial power was put in, when the initial roads were put in and the port expansion, that was all absorbed rather quickly. Now what we're seeing is they're moving the infrastructure construction to other parts of China where the take-up is going to be a little bit slower. I've just been traveling in Gansu and Tibet, and the infrastructure build-out out there is fantastic. But a lot of that is about income inequality and political stability, and that's the government's choice to spend what's effectively government money on those things. But we can also see that Chongqing, for example, Chengdu, have become economic powerhouses. In fact, some of the fastest growth in exports is now coming from Sichuan because of the infrastructure build out there. Most of the new jobs are coming there. Consumption is now growing there. So I think this has been, in general, well done. I don't think we're seeing any NPLs from this, because you're talking about the government asking a government-owned bank to lend money to a government agency to build government-designated public infrastructure. NPL rates are rising because more and more of the loans are going to small private companies, and everywhere in the world, small private companies are a risky place to lend to. And so the question really is not about a collapse in the financial system. It's looking at each individual bank. How good a job are they doing at assessing and pricing the risk of lending to the small private companies who are the majority of the borrowers now, and what's the impact of this on their profitability? On the consumption side, I think what I would say is keep in mind that spending on your kids' education, spending on your healthcare, that's consumption. That's an important part of the consumption. And it's true that a lot of the spending by Chinese families, particularly in the middle class and lower middle class, is on those things, but that's part of the consumption story. It's also true that the healthcare safety net in China is terrible. It's a little better than it was before, and that's why the savings rate is so high. So if the government is successful in building out the health insurance system, then savings rates will decline, and we'll see a very, very gradual improvement over an extended period of time. But, again, I want to emphasize, if income is rising in real terms, inflation-adjusted terms, it's 7%, the spending capacity of Chinese people is a lot better than the spending capacity of most of the world.
With that, it's 2 o'clock sharp. We always like to try to get everybody out the door here on time, but we also try to give our guests something to remember the club by. For the next time you come upstairs here, we've got an FCC tie. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much for coming. If you're interested in more along these lines, on the Matthews Asia website, we have a Sinology page which has my written research. I can, sure.
And Andy also says he'll stay up here if you have further questions and want to come up here. Thank you.
Well, thank you. All seems to go smoothly. We try to keep a...
appreciate the signal. Yeah, that's fine. Thanks for hosting.
Thank you,
great. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, too. Have a good safe trip back.
Thanks.